Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by former labor leader Don Turner, John O'Hara of the Illinois Policy Institute, and economics professor David Merriman from the University of Illinois at Chicago. Our phone lines open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. Coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. If you'd like to drop us an email, our email address, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to watch and listen to this broadcast, you can go to our website, which is www.beyondthebeltway.com. And again, we archive this program, so if you miss it or like what you hear and see, you can share it with your friends and neighbors for a long, long time. It's up there for many, many months. So again, we thank you for joining us this evening. For the next couple of hours, we're going to be talking about budget-related matters. We're going to talk a little bit about what's happening in Wisconsin and Ohio and starting to happen in other states around the United States as far as collective bargaining is concerned and some of the attempts to balance budgets, which obviously have turned somewhat controversial. In the second hour, we'll be talking a bit more about the budget battle on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. We begin with Don Turner. Don Turner, for many, many years, was the president of the Chicago Federation of Labor. He's been retired for about 7 years now. Used to be a teacher, classroom teacher, as well as a union organizer. Don, I asked this question last week, and I want to begin the broadcast with it this evening. Based on all the publicity, all the focus that you have read and seen about what's happening in the state of Wisconsin and the issues involving state governments and labor, what do you think is the biggest misconception that the general public might have about what this story is all about, in your view?
I think there's a misconception that the public feels it's going to save money by making these cuts. The whole thing is being advertised as we're broke, we need to make these cuts. But you have such economic liberals as Goldman Sachs, who says when you make cuts, you reduce growth, and each percent that you make a cut in, you reduce growth by about 1.2%, and that translates into millions of jobs.
John O'Hara joins us. He is a vice president of the Illinois Policy Institute. John, nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
What do you think is the biggest misconception that might be out there?
Biggest misconception, I think, would be that the governor in Wisconsin, for example, is trying to take away collective bargaining rights. The reality is that it's changing the terms of collective bargaining rights, but in terms of wages, they're actually still going to be allowed to collectively bargain.
Wait.
I want to get David Merriman's responses first from the University of Illinois at Chicago. Go ahead, and then we'll get back to Don.
I think the biggest misconception is that the fiscal crisis in the states was brought on by the recession, when in fact it's been building for many, many years. And it has to do with fundamentally the way we do business, I think. And I think we're going to really have to rethink a lot of things to get back on a fiscally sustainable path.
Now let's go back to Don, because you were taking exception to some things that John said.
Well, look, we've always defined collective bargaining as talking about wages, hours, and conditions of employment. And what the governor in Wisconsin is attempting to do is to say that the only thing you can negotiate about is wages, and you freeze the ceiling on wages and limit them to the inflationary aspect of it. And that's not collective bargaining in any way, shape, or form, as anybody in the United States knows it today.
I think a lot of it's semantics. The bottom line is they can still collectively bargain on their wages, which is the main compensation. To address Don's misconception about states not being broke and how this wouldn't save money, I think it couldn't be farther from the truth.
Well, then maybe you can explain why the governor in Wisconsin passed out $137 million as cuts to business right before this so-called crisis.
The bottom line is the idea that cuts are somehow going to reduce growth is absolutely absurd. Every time you spend a dollar of taxpayer dollars on government, that's money not being spent in the private sector, not being invested to create real lasting jobs.
As Don just asked, did Governor Walker, prior to this, brouhaha that we're involved right now that the public is aware of, did he pass on some breaks to the business
tax
community?
Cuts a bit, yes.
Okay, so that is $7 million worth.
Does that have any bearing on, again, on the fiscal issue of the state of Wisconsin?
No, I don't think so. The in terms of in terms of revenue directly, sure. In terms of long term sustainability and job growth and keeping businesses in Wisconsin, I think that's what you want to be doing. That's one of the reasons you want to be able to be giving. You want to be able to give. Be able to lower taxes, lower barrier to entry for entrepreneurs so they can create jobs.
David's chomping at the bit.
Well, I guess, you know, the effect of taxes on business growth and on economic growth is somewhat controversial, but it's certainly the policy that you just do away with all taxes would not generate growth. You need services, you need taxes,
sure.
You need kind of a balance there. I mean, the question is, how do you tax and what services do you provide? It shouldn't be the level of taxation.
Businesses, to assume that all businesses' decisions are made on tax rates is ridiculous. They make taxes on the educational quality of the workforce. They make decisions based on the public services that are offered by communities, a lot of things other than taxes. And what the governor in Wisconsin did was he took a very narrow view. It's clearly a power grab. And exactly the way he did it, let's call it what it is, it's a power grab. And this has to do with the fact that unions, generally speaking, support Democrats, and they're one of the basis points of the Democratic Party.
85% to 90% of their donations go to Democrats.
That's correct. We do donate to Republicans here in Illinois. We endorsed, George Ryan. We endorsed Jim Thompson, Republicans running for governor. We don't always
So when the voters last November elected Governor Walker, who articulated some of these positions, if not all.
He didn't articulate some of the most heinous ones.
But some of them.
Some of them, absolutely.
The voters clearly had a choice, and they selected him, and they wanted him to basically run the state of Wisconsin. And he is doing that.
But the recent polling, Bruce, what it shows is that 60% of the people in 61% are actually against what he's doing.
But power goes when people vote. Every 4 years, and so he has the will of the people because they have given him the power. So now he is choosing to use the power. Now, what you're saying is he didn't tell everything he was going to do. So, John, let me ask you: do you agree with that assessment that maybe what Scott Walker said during the campaign wasn't everything he's doing now?
I think throughout his career he's been pretty clear. Maybe not everything, but 99% of what he's doing. And I think he thinks he's doing what he was elected to do. And the reality is elections have consequences. You didn't see Republicans hiding out in Canada during the Obamacare fight because they didn't have the numbers, like you see Democrats hiding out in Illinois. He's looking at the numbers, and it doesn't add up. Something needs to be done to change it.
I want to talk about what's happening in Wisconsin. We have to break, and also then we're going to talk about its ability to spread elsewhere in the Midwest, including in the state of Ohio. We will talk about that when we continue. 1-800-723-8289 tonight, taking America's political pulse on budget problems at the state and in the federal government. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. David Merriman is with us. He is the Associate Director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. And I want to ask a question about what the focus has been primarily on the state of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. But as you look at America's heartland and its states around the United States, how similar are their problems to what's happening in Wisconsin?
Well, Wisconsin's actually in fiscally a lot of better shape than many other states. It's got its pension fund is relatively well funded, and it's got some budget deficit, but it's not a huge one. But I think the kind of political precedent that's been set, the battle in Wisconsin, is spreading around the country to many other states.
Donna,
Dave, I would like to ask a question. Are the states that have unions as a majority bargaining agents the only states in fiscal trouble?
No, there are many states that don't have right-to-work laws and don't have government unions that have fiscal problems.
So these fiscal problems really can't be laid at the foot of unions in those states, can they, like they're trying to do in these states?
Well, it's certainly the case that it's not only unions. There are many factors that contribute to fiscal problems.
Give us an example of a few. Again, these are states that don't have a huge union presence.
Yeah.
Are there any off the top of your head that...
Texas, Louisiana, there's basically any state south of the Mason-Dixon line.
Doing much better than Illinois, for example. Indiana, our neighbor, similar weather, unlike some of these other states where people say, you know, people are leaving Illinois for places mm-hmm. like Texas and Florida because of the weather. Indiana obviously has the same weather. Mitch Daniels in 2005 outlawed public employee.
But you'd be hard-pressed to say that the labor costs in Illinois are the cost of the result of the fiscal problem or the cause of the fiscal problem. The cause of the fiscal problem in Illinois is many, many years of underfunding pensions, many, many years of not doing basic math to make things add up.
Underfunding pensions that long ago went the way of the dodo in the private sector defined benefit plans with a guaranteed 8% return.
A couple of questions here. Is the underfunding of pensions, is that a common denominator in the states that are in trouble?
No. I mean, Wisconsin clearly did not underfund its pensions. Wisconsin did a good job of funding its pensions. It's got fiscal problems.
Is a common denominator that some of the pensions that are in existence in those states probably should have had significant reform long ago, which I think John has suggested.
I don't think it's so much the structure of the pensions as the funding of the pensions. The problem with pensions is that the deferred compensation. You earn the compensation at one point. You get paid at another point. It's very, very tempting in both the public and the private sector. We've seen this throughout the country in the private sector. Not to fully fund the pensions because you don't have to pay them then. We've done the same thing with Medicaid, Medicare at the national level, to some extent with Social Security, much lesser extent at the national level. When there's a time lag between when the benefits are earned and when they're paid, it's very difficult to force yourself to put the money away.
John O'Hare.
It's to answer your question, Bruce, it's a little bit of both. It is the structure of these things. They're out of sync with the private sector, out of sync with reality. In Wisconsin, for example, public employees pay little to nothing into their pension program, whereas their neighbors in the private sector have to save their own money and do that in addition to paying into Social Security, which they also don't do.
Let me just stop for just a second. Don, is that fair?
No.
Okay.
In Illinois, which is a different structure, and the one I can talk about personally, I was a teacher here in Illinois. I get a teacher's pension. I made a contribution to the pension. We paid in considerably higher. We paid in 8 to 9% into our teacher pension, considerably higher than the private sector. Our employer, the city of Chicago, put their requisite dollars in there up until about the year 2000. The state of Illinois, which had an obligation under the law and the Constitution to make its contribution, failed to make its contribution. So what we have is a situation now where people come around and they point at me as a teacher and say, well, you're responsible for us having this problem. No, I'm not. We paid in what we should have. The city of Chicago paid in what it should have. The state of Illinois did not live up to its legal obligation, and it bears the responsibility for that. And that is true in most of these cases where the legislature in these states did not make the requisite contribution, just exactly as Dave said. It was easier to say, well, that's something that gone when that guy...
So Don, because in the state of Illinois there's been Democratic control for so long, and because, as you acknowledged earlier, the Democrats almost universally support Democrats, not always, but again, strong support in Illinois, does the union and does the union movement bear some responsibility for continuing to elect and reelect lawmakers who keep sweeping things under the rug?
Well, Bruce, this is a problem that's been around for about 50 years. It's the responsibility of Republicans and Democrats.
Is it a problem of the unions? My point is, as you say, you've given money to Republicans and you've given money to Democrats.
Predominantly Democrats.
Predominantly, but the point is,
significant.
does the union bear some responsibility
for
perpetuating this aura of irresponsible?
Bruce, more fundamental.
But it's the DNA of politicians to avoid putting money in today for a problem that's going to be created 30 and 40 years down the road.
More fundamentally, I think the voters bear some responsibility. We all bear some responsibility because we want services, but we don't want to pay for them. And the politicians bear responsibility for lying to us, and we bear responsibility for listening to them.
John.
I'm going to say something dramatic. I agree with Don in one narrow sense. There are a few issues that we're talking about here. They're linked, but they're separate issues. There's the deal. Yes, the city of Chicago, the state of Illinois should honor the deal. They should honor the deal that they make. But then there's the fundamental question of, is the deal sustainable? Should we change the deal going forward, whether it's for teachers in Chicago or government employees as a whole in Illinois or Wisconsin or on the federal level? And then third, there's that fundamental issue of politicians kicking the can down the road and also not really acting like every family does, where they sit down and they say, okay, here's our budget. This is the money we have. This is what we want to spend it on. We're going to prioritize it. A family sits down and says, this is the mortgage, this is the car payment. Time and time again, whether it's in Springfield or in D.C., politicians don't do that. They essentially shop without price tags and spend like it's going out of style, and it's not even their money.
Do private sector workers have better pension benefits than public sector workers?
On the whole, they do. But what we should look at is the total compensation, which is wages and pension benefits in general. The public sector offers somewhat better benefits and somewhat lower wages. There's a lot of studies on this, a lot of debate. I think it's not clearly resolved one way or another.
The average federal employee makes about $122,000 a year. The average public sector employee
makes
$122,000. $61,000.
Based on our
I'll show you the study when we get to the break.
You're talking mailmen make $120,000 a year. This is really a revelation to me.
I'll double check my numbers.
Okay. I think you best. I think you best. I want you to sit here and think about this.
I'll give you some examples. For example, in Illinois, on the state level,
okay,
barber. You walk into a barbershop, on average, makes about $25,000. For the state of Illinois, they make $60,000 to $75,000. That's unsustainable.
Why does Illinois have barbers?
That's a great question. most of them are at the Department of Corrections, shaving inmates' hair. They're not doing anything too complicated, perms or anything like that.
What are they making at the DOC then?
Over $60,000. On average.
Over $60,000. Yes.
And
prisoners in Illinois.
Whereas a barber, you know, in any listener's neighborhood.
That's still a long way from this $120,000.
Would you acknowledge that sounds like quite a difference?
I'll acknowledge that's quite a difference.
And what union is that?
AFSCME would be, or SEIU would be.
Okay. So you're shocked at that, Don. But now let's go back to your other figures.
I think it's important to understand when we talk about budget problems of the state, a very small share of what the state spend is actually for compensation for workers. About wages are only about 8% of state budgets. Mostly what states spend money on is things like Medicaid, which go to private providers or for things like building roads contracting out to the private sector. So you can't lay budget problems in the state on the wages of workers.
But, and correct me if I'm wrong, throughout the United States, if you look at the fastest growing sector of state spending, and I believe it's now in second place, it is the Department of Corrections. Corrections are growing because the public is demanding that their lawmakers send more and more people away so they can go to prison, where in Illinois they can get their hair cut by somebody that's making $60,000 a year. Seriously,
it's true that corrections is growing fast. It's also true that corrections is a really small portion of the budget. It's about 1 or 2% of the budget. We shouldn't focus on corrections. We should focus on health care and Medicaid in particular. That's the thing that's driving at both the national level and at the state level the fiscal problems that we have. That is
the reason I brought that up is because you said in the last segment, you say people want more, but they don't want to pay for it.
That's true.
So what I'm saying is if people want to keep sending people to prison, maybe for lesser crimes, that's costing them as taxpayers, even if it's a smaller percentage of the budget.
Sure.
And
absolutely.
Again, who knows? We just have one example.
In Illinois.
And I want to meet that $60,000 a year.
Bruce.
Barber. Go ahead.
You'd get a discount.
10 more seconds.
In Illinois, we have 40,000 people incarcerated. And it's a number that I think is absurd facing with all these problems in front of us. It calls for a redress of the criminal code.
2 million nationally. Well, you know, we've got to pause right now. 1-800-723-8029. We've got a lot of callers on the line. We have monopolized the conversation. We'll bring you into it when we come back from Chicago. From Sacramento, California to Worcester, Mass., you are listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Every Sunday night, border to border and coast to coast. Tonight, talking about the budget matters at the state level. And in hour number two, we'll be talking about the battle of the budget on Capitol Hill. Don Turner is one of our guests this evening. He is the president emeritus of the Chicago Federation of Labor. Held that position for 7 years. Has now been retired for about 7 years. He was a teacher for many, many years in the Chicago public school system. John O'Hara also joins us. He is vice president of external relations for the Illinois Policy Institute. He's also author of the book, A New American Tea Party. Also worked for the U.S. Department of Labor and the Heartland Institute. And in 50 words or less, what is the Illinois Policy Institute, John?
Well, the Institute is a free market think tank. We have an office here in Chicago and in Springfield, and our goal is to advance liberty-based public policy for a better Illinois.
Also with us this evening is David Merriman. He was appointed the Associate Director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs in August of last year after serving 1 year as head of the Department of Economics at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And you work with Robert Reich in that area. And
yes, that's right.
Tell us a little bit about the Institute of Government and Public Affairs and what is your mission?
We do evidence-based research about public policy, and our mission is to improve the discussion of public policy and the implementation of policy.
When someone in academia, and we have frequent guests from academia on this broadcast, when you do a survey, a report, an analysis, you spend, obviously, as you say, it's the academic think tank, just as John has a think tank. All right, you do all this work. You've got it. You bound it in a nice book. Who do you give it to, and how often do they actually do something with the research you provided?
Well, in the case of the Institute, we make a lot of effort to give it to the people who have the power to make decisions. That includes working with the legislature, the state legislature in Illinois, or local public officials, or nationally, whoever. We also try and give it to advocates and give it to other people around. How often do they act on it? I think, I've been in this business for a long time, and I've developed a bit of patience. Often they don't act on it immediately. It takes a while to work its way into the DNA of the legislative process. I think our main goal is to try and focus the discussion on what the most important topics are and hope that through the political process we'll get a balance of the interests of lots of different groups.
Do they generally come back to you? And, John, I want to get your reaction to the same question. Do they frequently come back to you and say, David, this is a great report. We think you're sound research, but you know what? David, there's just no way we can do this. You're in your ivory tower. You and your academic friends come up with great public policy, but you know what? If I move forward on this, I'll never get reelected. I mean, do you get that a lot?
I've heard that. Definitely, I've heard that. And you try and work with them and say, well, what parts might you be able to do? What is politically feasible? How can we move in the right direction?
John, what's your take? What's your answer to those same questions?
I largely agree with it. You know, I think that you tend to put you put out what the best policy would be. It might not always be politically feasible, but it's very interesting how quickly that can change. You know, a year or two ago, we put out a public a pension funding and fairness act about fully funding the pensions in Illinois, fixing the pension system long term, and you know, certain folks said to us, you know, that's just not doable. This past session. Mike Madigan was pushing pension reform, albeit watered down pension reform, but a step in a good direction.
And where does your funding come from?
Our funding comes from individuals and foundations and concerned taxpayers.
Don, what is your general assessment of the public policy folks and how often they may come back to unions as the bad guys in their scenarios? Not that these gentlemen do, but I'm just saying that frequently happens because I think that's part of where the public perception is about unions right now.
Actually, the public has two perceptions about unions. There's a perception that they're negative, they've done negative things. But I think people recognize that they're a necessary counterweight in a democracy to the power of money and greed. Otherwise, you'd have an oligarchy running the country, a bunch of rich people funding think tanks. Funding candidates and so on. So I think the public recognizes that unions are necessary. If we just look back in history and we say to ourselves, at this time and place, could you pass Social Security? Could you pass Medicare for seniors? Could you pass the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, your right to know what chemicals you work with, COBRA, ERISA? None of those things could be passed in this environment.
Do you think that that's
one of the... But those are all good things for America.
Do you think that's one of the reasons why, at least in popular perception, that what's going on in the state of Wisconsin, if you ask the average person who's not a union member, if someone should have to be in a union and that the state is assisting in the collection of union dues, and they say, why are we doing this? Can you imagine why
because
the public may not think that's a good idea?
Well, look, you're the elected collective bargaining agent. What it means to be the collective bargaining agent, everybody recognizes one person has no power in the process. So people bargain collectively. If you're the elected collective bargaining agent, no one requires you to make political contributions as a union member. Those are done outside of the union dues process. You know, they're independent, voluntary contributions in almost every union today.
That's not accurate.
No, that is accurate. In almost every union, they're independently collected. They're voluntary contributions.
I thought in Wisconsin they're collected by the state.
They are.
The collection is by the state, but the member signs a card asking to have this done. The member voluntarily signs a card.
That's sometimes the case. It's also but more often than not, you actually have to opt out of your dues going towards political contributions. But the reality
is
a large amount.
But they want to be asked once a year. That's part of the controversy.
But you can. It's voluntary. The member can opt out or the member can opt in, whichever system you have. But it's the member who makes that decision. It's not somebody else.
And what Governor Walker in the Wisconsin example is saying that he wants to empower the workers to be able to make that decision once a year. Why anyone, including a union organizer, would be against
back
that?
Up. The governor, what he wants is he wants to have no voluntary contribution. He wants the union to go around to each member and collect the dues. He doesn't want to. Employer to be the agent. He wants a certification vote each year. He wants the vote to be not just of the employees voting, but to be a vote of all the employees. He's doing everything possible. This is just a subterfuge to go after union power because unions generally represented and vote for Democrats. And that's what the ultimate thing of this is.
I want to get David to weigh in on this, and then we're going to take some calls.
Okay. I mean, I think clearly the policies that Governor Walker is proposing are designed to make it more cumbersome to have a union. I mean, so the question is, do we want to have a legal right to have public unions? They don't have that in every state, but it's, I think, disingenuous to say that the policies are totally reasonable and anyone who was in a union would support them. They're designed to make it more difficult to have a union.
I just go back. I mean, if the unions are doing such a good job representing the public, their constituents, public employees. I don't understand.
Well, you just told me their wages and benefits are much higher than everybody else's, so they must be doing a good job.
So then they would get recertified every year,
they would be recertified every year, no problem. So what's, I don't understand what the concern is.
Let's go to Bonnie in Crown Point, Indiana, listening to us on our flagship station, WLS. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know, when you're talking about this Wisconsin, you know, story, I mean, when you think about it, I think what the governor's trying to do when he restricts the collective bargaining process is because of the budget as a whole, he's going to have a huge number of cuts. And a lot of those cuts are going to be passed down to the city and the county government. So in other words, where he may have sent them $100,000, maybe now he'll only send them $15,000. And he knows that they're going to feel a huge amount of pain, and he is trying to give them more flexibility in their budgeting process. So whereas he's closing a door sort of as far as, you know, money goes, he's kind of opening a window to say, yeah, but, you know, we're going to give you a little relief in this way. Now, as far as the union thing goes, I mean, realistically speaking, I really, and my mother is a retired state of Illinois teacher, I don't really understand why the government that's strapped for cash has to go through the work and the expense of collecting the union dues. I mean, there's plenty of union dues money that's collected. The unions should be able to afford to collect their own dues. And a woman was talking on the radio a couple weeks ago, and she was one of those teachers who didn't leave the classroom. And she says, you know, she says, there's a lot of teachers like us. She says, some of them are conservative, and we didn't leave the classroom. And she says, and quite frankly, we don't like where the union negotiates, gets us higher wages, and then takes away a portion of that as dues, and then hands it off to a Democratic politician that we would never support on our own in a million years.
Let's
that's not a very democratic process.
Let's let Don Turner respond because he was president emeritus of the Chicago Federation of Labor and was a teachers union.
Well, we got a lot of issues there. First of all, let's back up on the governor of Wisconsin. Mubarak, I think his name was, wasn't it?
No, we're gonna pause here because she's asked a couple of questions. We're about to go to a break. Bonnie, stay on the line. We're going to put you on hold. Stay on the line. We're going to let Don talk to you when you come back, okay? Back shortly from Chicago. From Crown Heights in New York to Crown Point, Indiana, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway. And before the break, Bonnie was on the line. She still is on the line with us, Don Turner. You wanted to respond to part of her question, and I know David did as well. Go ahead.
Well, the first part of the question was about the governor and his actions. What the governor's doing in his actions...
Governor Mubarak Walker.
What he's doing in his actions is he's trying to do a lot of things in a very authoritarian way. For example, in the bill that's up there, it says that he can sell public utilities, which the government owns now, without a bid. Okay, that's one of his things. And he also wants to be able to determine eligibility for Medicaid. He wants to be able to prohibit tax increases for individual school districts or individual districts, municipalities, and so on, that want to add taxes to make up for the difference in what the state's reducing it by. So he wants to be able to control this in an authoritarian way. And the fundamental aspect of these things is a significant reduction in the public's ability to be involved in the decision-making process. That's what he's doing at the root of it.
David, you wanted to add something to Bonnie's questions?
I just wanted to comment on the point that she made that perhaps one of the advantages of weakening unions in Wisconsin would be that as cuts get pushed down to the local level, it would give them more flexibility. So the real question is whether getting rid of unions improves the process of making the cuts. If you get rid of unions, then you have less avenues for formal input from the workers about what's the effect of these cuts. That sometimes the workers might protect their own self-interest, but also the workers have a lot of information to convey. So the view that academics have of unions is generally that they're a device to bring information, to siphon information and bring it up to a higher level. And getting rid of the unions might make that harder to do. It might actually encourage more resistance. So I think that's a real concern.
But given what's happening in Wisconsin, as we said earlier in the broadcast, this is being watched in other state capitals. And let's talk a little bit about what's happening in Columbus and in the state of Ohio. John Kasich, obviously, he's got Republican control of both houses there, and looks like that's another dateline for this battle, John.
It is. And look, state after state, with the exception of Illinois, is going in the direction of lowering taxes and taking on the public employee unions and their bloated salaries and pensions. And I think it's governors showing some leadership and facing reality. I wish we had someone doing that here in Illinois. Mm-hmm.
But in reality, I mean, if we like what's going on in Wisconsin and we say the voters of Wisconsin chose one road to walk down, the voters in Illinois had a clear choice between two candidates for governor, and the one that wanted to walk down the road to increase taxes won.
So narrowly and with less than half of the vote.
That's like a landslide.
I think the problem with Illinois is that neither candidate came anywhere near telling the truth to the voters. Both candidates talked about solutions that weren't near to the scale of the problem.
Let's go to David, listening to us in Chicago. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Gentlemen, hello.
Yes.
I got some few comments about this. There's a saying that there are three sides to every story, your side, my side, and the truth. And I think this is one of those issues. I'm on the free market side. I'm a libertarian. I believe in the free market. I'm against monopolies. Most of what government does is monopoly. I'll take it when I have to take it. But to have government unions is monopoly on top of monopoly.
Exactly.
And so I'm against that. However, the other side is correct, too. The union guys are pointing out most of these Republicans and so-called conservatives, they are wanting to bust not only government unions, they're trying to bust all unions. They are trying to do away with any kind of unionism whatsoever. These are the same guys. They're on Fox TV, Fox Business Channel, saying, "Are unions bankrupting America?" And these guys are the guys that say that Walmart is the free market. And you can tell these guys are just chomping at the bit to, like, destroy, stomp out any vestige of labor unions in America. That's why I can't get with these guys. It's very cynical what they're doing.
That's why the government
union guys, much as I disagree with them, I think they're winning the PR battle, because they could say, hey, these guys are just, they're trying to foment this class war against workers. And so I can't side with really either side in this issue.
Let's let John respond, and then we'll go back to you, David. Go ahead, John.
There is a class warfare going on, and the new class warfare, particularly in Wisconsin, is public employees and everybody else who pays their salaries. For example, Governor Walker is asking them to pay a little over 12% for their health care benefits, and they've found that outrageous, and their leadership found that outrageous, whereas their neighbors, the average Wisconsin resident pays 27% for their health care benefits. Excuse me, average American pays 27%, average Wisconsin resident pays 20%. And I'm really glad that we're getting to this public versus private issue. The governor is not attacking private sector unions. What the governor's
talking. I understand that. It's part of a larger agenda, though.
Right.
And he
proved the larger agenda by
actions. They're trying to get as much mileage as they can, because government unions, they're an easy target. They got greedy, okay? They're an easy target, and they're linking this together with Walmart, you know, calling Walmart the free market. That's ridiculous. Walmart is the biggest welfare queen there is. They get government. They get tax subsidies everywhere they build a store. They use slave labor by proxy in China. That's not free market. And you have these guys out there calling themselves libertarians who are saying government unions are bad. All unions are bad. Let's kill unions.
Let's let Don Turner. David, let's let Don Turner respond, and then John, and I think David's wants to comment as well.
The governor revealed himself very clearly when he exempted from all this police unions and fire unions, because those unions support Republicans. Why were they exempt?
Their unions gave less than, I think, $5,000 total to his campaign.
But why were those two unions exempted? If he was going after public sector unions, why did he exempt them? Because those unions endorsed Republicans in the state of Wisconsin.
David, David, are you still there? David is gone. David's asked a lot of great questions. Unfortunately, he did it at the end of the hour. However, we're going to pick up on this discussion on the other side. Thanks very much for being with us. Don Turner has been with us, labor leader, former labor leader, as well as David Merriman. And also joining us this evening is John O'Hare. They'll all be back in hour number two when we will continue our discussion and broaden it out. We will be talking about now that we've solved all the problems with the state level, we'll talk about the federal budget in the next hour. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway, coming to you live from Chicago tonight, featuring commentary by former labor leader Don Turner, John O'Hara of the Illinois Policy Institute, and economics professor David Merriam from the University of Illinois at Chicago. Phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to send us an email, the email address is btb@museum.tv. And again, a reminder, if you want to go to our website, it's beyondthebeltway.com. And again, we have previous broadcasts where you can watch them for weeks in, weeks out for a long, long time. So this broadcast will go in the time machine for a long, long time. In hour number one, if you have been with us for the last hour, you know we were talking about what's happening in the state of Wisconsin and Ohio and at the statewide level insofar as some of the budget issues facing those states. But, of course, the bigger, broader issue is what is happening budget-wise in the United States. And in this hour, we're going to talk a little bit about it. But we do have some unfinished business from hour number one. And I know that at one point in the discussion in the first hour, John O'Hara, who is with the Illinois Policy Institute, he stated as fact a startling statistic, which our other two guests raised their eyebrows about, as well as I did, I might say. It was a little startling. So for those of you who missed it, say it again, John, and then state your source of information.
Sure. It's an August 2010 USA Today article that shows that the average federal employee makes over $123,000 in total compensation, including benefits, compared to their private sector counterparts that are paying said salaries make a little over $61,000 on average.
Now, does that include members of the military?
I assume it does.
And postal workers?
Yes.
And are our guests still startled at that?
Well, originally, I had thought it was wages, and compensation is, of course, more. And federal workers are much better educated on average than the average private sector employer. I'm still surprised, but not as shocked.
Don?
I'm surprised about it, too. And I would question how the data was put together and what workers are included in this package of data and so on, which I think you'd really need to know to take a hard look at this.
But if you look at the two figures, it would seem to me that the ability to come up with what the private sector is paying, the average of $61,000, that would probably be easier to determine, right? So the $61,000 figure is probably a more believable figure to you?
That would be people working on an assembly line. That would be people working in higher levels. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Just data like this, when the numbers are so startling, I think it's fair to say that, I'd like to see the sources of how this was compiled and so on.
John?
I'll send it to everyone on the panel, and you can put it up on your site if you'd like. And it was compiled
You can actually – we're going to ask everybody to get a pen or pencil because you can give – before we go off there, you can give your website, and if they want to send an email to you, you can send it directly to them.
Perfect. IllinoisPolicy.org.
Okay. And again, the figures were compiled initially by the Heartland Institute?
No. Some of it came from Heritage Foundation.
Foundation.
This is actually reported by USA Today, and it was compiled by the Bureau of Economic Analysis.
Okay. So it is USA Today's story about figures released by a conservative think tank.
Nope, by the Bureau of Economic Analysis. I was referencing a different Heritage thing before.
Okay, very good. I just want to be clear on that. And the other point that we talked about in hour number one was the use of money in politics. And Don acknowledged that the union money over the last many, many decades primarily has gone to Democrats, even though there are some exceptions where Republicans have got it.
I think it's fair to say business money goes primarily to Republicans.
Right.
And it's about 50-50, Republicans and Democrats, whereas unions
the business
about
community
80,
money is
50-50? Yes. Which is fine. And look, the bottom line is that Don brought up funding. It was in the context of talking. We were talking about this Wisconsin battle somehow being a war on unions. There's a couple points I wanted to bring up in response to that. Number one, we're talking about public sector government unions and private sector unions, two very different things. And as the caller brought up before, one of them is essentially a monopoly on a monopoly. I don't think anyone here is saying we need to get rid of all unions. I'm certainly not advocating that. I don't hear Governor Walker advocating that. What I think people are concerned with when it comes to unions is in the public sector is that they're the Goliath in the room. That of the top three of the top five contributors in the last election cycle were unions. The number one was a government employee union that spent over $91 million. AFSCME.
This is in Wisconsin.
No, federally. Across the board. Nationally, excuse me. Thank you.
Well, I have different numbers.
What numbers do you have?
I have of the top five donors, the last of the top five was a union, AFSCME, and that was in the last election cycle. And that was...
Who do you have as first? Because the figures that I recall was that the three of the top five were unions, but... But again, does everybody acknowledge?
In the 2008 election, two of the top five were unions. In the 2010 election, of the top five, only one was a union, and that was the last one. And that was primarily a result of a Supreme Court decision, which should change the way in which funding occurred. And, I think the Supreme Court...
We have Sam in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, listening to us on WRNN. And Sam, your point, as I understand it, is, and we're sort of talking about your issue right now, which is why I wanted to engage you in this conversation. You see it purely as Republicans against Democrats, pro-union against pro-business oxes to gore, right?
Well, I see it as a divide-and-conquer strategy. Both sides are really guilty. And the thing that's really bringing down the country, I think, is corrupt politicians and cronyism. You got the Democrats and the labor unions and all the special interest groups and the minorities on the left. And then on the right, you have the crony capitalism of the Republicans and, to a large extent, crony capitalism with the Democrats. It's just the crony capitalists, the corrupt politicians, the unions, it's all the same thing. But the taxpayers can't keep paying for all this.
David, do you agree with that? You got a smile on your face.
I don't think crony capitalism describes accurately the way things work. I think that we're, as a people, much more guilty of creating these problems, of letting the system go on and really, as I said before, wanting politicians to lie to us.
Well, we tried to correct the system, Dave. Remember, there were attempts to reform the power of money in elections. And what happened? The Supreme Court overturned that. And its majesty, what it's given us is a system that would best be described by Anatole France, where he said, the law in its majesty prevents rich men and poor men from sleeping under the bridge. Well, you don't really find a lot of rich men sleeping under the bridge. So, you know, the law works to favor the very, very rich, what the Supreme Court did. And in doing that, there are no institutions to counterweight the power of money and greed. Unions are one of the few institutions. And as I said before, what would have a chance of passing today? Let me ask you, the Clean Air Act, do you think you could pass that today? Your right to know what chemicals you work with. You think you could pass that given the corporate lobby today? I don't think so. The Clean Water Act, ERISA, COBRA, Social Security. You couldn't pass those things in Congress today, and they're things that benefit everybody in this country.
I want to get John, give him an opportunity to respond, as well as David, and also we got callers on the line. 1-800-723-8289. Again, we'll be back shortly from Chicago. From Austin, Texas to Ashtabula, Ohio, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Don Turner, you had made a point before the break about that many of the things that Americans take for granted and benefits that they have in their daily operational lives would never pass again. And I wanted to give John an opportunity to say whether he agrees with that or not, given this political climate.
That may be true, and I want to address something that came up before. I think there's no question that the union and the labor movement has a proud history in the United States, of standing up for the little man, of accomplishing great things. But when Don talks about the wealthy, big money in politics, it's ironic because again, the biggest players in politics in terms of political power and pure dollars is the labor movement. Whether it's on the federal level, where federal workers are on average making twice as much as their private sector counterparts, or whether it's in Illinois with the barber making $25,000, subsidizing the barber makes $60,000 who works for the state. What we're talking about here is the working class and poor subsidizing millionaire pensions for public employee unions.
How many think tanks does the labor community sponsor versus how many do millionaires and billionaires sponsor? How many lobbyists does labor have versus how many lobbyists the business community has? I mean, we're overwhelmed by these numbers. We're overwhelmed in those fields by these numbers.
In the 2010 election cycle, AFSCME, one union, one public employee union, spent $91 million, as reported by the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, compared to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, $75 million. That's significantly more. And again, of course, the chamber's not only giving to Republicans, not heavily weighted towards Republicans in the sense that AFSCME is
weighted to Democrats. If you look at money in politics, if you look at the Democrats and Republicans, there's a fairly even split, usually with Republicans raising a bit more than Democrats. So the idea that money is driving the political situation to be really different than it otherwise would be, I think, is not true.
Let's talk about different kinds of money. I think we will all agree that unions and business, they spend a lot of money trying to buy favors with the men and women who they helped elect to Congress.
Bruce, let me just stop you right there for a moment. Who benefits by those favors? If the business community does it, it's the wealthy in this country that benefit by what you call favors. Mm-hmm. When the unions do it, primarily it's people in the middle class, which is why I cited those things like COBRA, pension protection legislation, and so on. There's a fundamental institutional difference in who benefits from the money spent in politics.
When AFSCME spends $91 million, they're protecting a very a small class of people making significantly more
representing their members.
But here's a point. This is where I think the frustration, at least insofar as public sector unions, doesn't sound fair to a lot of people, because what you have is you have a union that represents public employees. They spend their clout. They use their financial clout to elect members of general assemblies who then basically are sitting there negotiating with them when they want to get – they're on both sides of the table.
Unions are on both sides of the table, and they're playing with other people's money.
Now, would you acknowledge that?
I think there's some issues there that have to be worked out. But on the other side –
how is it worked out? I mean –
well, I think that
one way that it might be worked out is that instead of automatically, having your dues paid every year, you go back to those unions and you say, okay, once a year, you've got to tell us whether you think we're doing a good job. Basically, let's say you don't want to do it every year, but let's say you want to do it every 2 years. A member of Congress has to go back to their bosses every 2 years and say, we think you're doing a good job.
Wait a minute.
Or we don't think you're a good
union
job.
Union leaders get reelected. That's how the members tell them if they're doing a good job or not. It's not that unions are not democratic institutions. They are democratic institutions.
Don, what's the worst that could happen if public employees had to vote every year to certify their union?
What happens is it's an undue burden on the union. Okay. It's absolutely a heck of a burden on the union, because what happens is it would actually work counter to what your intentions are. It would put more pressure on the union leadership to negotiate better and better agreements. You know, look, these unions are representing their members. That's what they do. We have what is called a fiduciary responsibility to our members. We have a response. For example, a union member comes to me with a grievance. I can't automatically turn that grievance down. I have a fiduciary responsibility. I take his dues money. I have to represent him. I may not personally even be in favor of the grievance, but I will do my best to represent him.
Folks, I promise to those who are listening to the broadcast that in hour number two, we're going to talk about some of the federal budgetary issues. And so let's just summarize, you know, where we are at the moment. Republicans have proposed to cut about $62 billion from current spending levels. Democrats have proposed to cut about $50 billion from the president's 2011 budget request, which was never passed. Now, and if they can't come to some conclusion, the government may shut down. There was a continuing resolution passed, so government right now is going to stay right where it is, keep moving along until March 18th. Maybe every couple of weeks they're going to have this continuing resolution. But at some point, just as the situation in Wisconsin will someday be resolved, who is going to blink first? And David, in your view, if you were blowing in the ear of the Republican and Democratic leadership, I want you to put on the table what advice you would give to each side on this. What would you be telling the Republicans
who are
worried that their constituents are demanding that they cut?
I would say the difference between $50 billion and $61 billion or $63 billion, whatever it is trivial when you've got an annual deficit of over $1 trillion, which is $1,000 billion. So what they should do is stop fighting about this and get down to thinking about what is the long-term plan to bring the budget back into balance. Fundamentally, to bring the budget back into balance for the long term, what we need to do is figure out what we're going to do about Medicare and Medicaid, health care expenses as the population ages.
So you'd be saying the same thing to the Republicans and Democrats.
I would absolutely be saying the same thing. Look at the long term. Go back. The president had a deficit commission. Go back. Make some serious choices.
John, in your view, does this Republican Congress now, especially the House, Do they have wiggle room in this debate, given the message that they received back in November?
Wiggle room to not institute
wiggle
real reform?
Wiggle
no,
room
I don't,
to
I don't.
Move off of 62 and say, oh, we're going to do it for 55 or 52 or...
Sure. Look, if a deal can be reached where they're going to shave off, 55, not 62, and there's some, as David talks about, some serious systemic suspending reform. Sure. But look, the bottom line is, number one, those numbers that we're talking about here, about roughly $50 billion cut versus $100 billion cut, it's off the baseline of a 2011 budget, as you said, that wasn't passed. What they're really talking about is 10 and 60, respectively. And that is a significant difference, $10 billion versus $60 billion. But look, they got to bring when David talked about people want to pay for things, people don't want to pay for things, but they want to get things. He wasn't talking about, you know, the Department of Corrections barber who's talking about Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. That's the big elephant in the room, or we'll say gorilla, just to be nonpartisan.
It's the big elephant in the room. And I don't think either party wants to be the first one to jump off a cliff and say, I'm going to take on Medicare and Social Security. Social Security is not the issue. I think David's 100% right. The federal budgetary problem is caused by three things: healthcare, and healthcare. I mean, it's all about healthcare. It's clearly what it is. And all this other stuff they're going after, you know, let's cut Pell Grants, let's put a stop on high-speed rail, and all these kind of things that represent about 12% of the budget. It isn't where it's not where the meat of this problem
is.
But if the goal of the Republicans is to defund Obamacare before it even gets started, is that their sole position? Is that their starting and ending position? And is that the issue they want to take to the voters in 2012.
It's hard to tell how much that's a political position and how much that's really a policy issue. I think for a lot of especially the new Tea Party people, it's a, you know, a real symbolic issue. In terms of the fiscal issues, I mean, the Congressional Budget Office said that actually Obamacare would reduce health care spending. It's a, it's not nearly enough, but it is a start. So I think that issue is not doesn't have to be the ending issue.
John, you've written a book called A New American Tea Party. This appears to be a group that doesn't give anybody any leeway.
I don't know if I don't know if I'd say that. You know, one of the big criticisms of the Tea Party to begin with was, you know, that sure they could throw rallies effectively, but can they really politic? And I think this past election cycle showed that while they had certainly had some high profile candidates like Sharon Angle that weren't successful, many of the candidates that they backed in primaries were successful, and I think they saw a real movement in Republican primaries to more fiscally conservative candidates.
Successful in the House, not so successful in the Senate.
But again,
listened to Michelle Bachmann on TV today. This does not look like a woman that wants to negotiate or blink at all, literally and figuratively.
Maybe not. Look, people feel that they were much like Scott Walker, that they were sent there with a job to do, and they're going to do it.
We're going to pause. 1-800-723-8289. We're talking now about the federal budget. If you have ideas on where it can cut, again, $62 billion sounds like a lot of money to cut. But as David said, drop in the bucket. Back shortly from Chicago.
For this now, because
from Boston, Massachusetts to Austin, Texas, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Around the table this evening, we have Don Turner is here. He was the president of the Chicago Federation of Labor for 7 years. He's been retired for 7 years and doing a lot of traveling with his wife around the world and also to just back from Hawaii. And also was a teacher for many years, a union activist, and also a classroom teacher. John O'Hara has also joined us. He is vice president of external relations for the Illinois Policy Institute, and he is author of a new book called A New American Tea Party. He also once worked for the Heartland Institute and also a couple of years for the U.S. Department of Labor. And also joining us this evening is David Merriman, and he is or was appointed the associate director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs in 2010. He is also a professor of economics and from the University of Illinois at Chicago, and also got his economics degree or master's in economics, as well as his PhD in economics from the University of Wisconsin. So spent a lot of time up in Madison, Wisconsin. 1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. We've been talking about the battles between the Republicans and Democrats. And, Don, you were making a point that the issue of discretionary funds either Republicans or Democrats are talking about, either saving the money or not saving it, is really just such a small piece of the fiscal pie.
My understanding is it represents about 12% of the federal budget, and that's where all the cuts are coming from. So what's being proposed is cuts to Small Business Institute, for example, $83 million, Pell Grants, which is $6 billion, which go to kids wanting to go to college, transportation, $8.1 billion. These are cuts coming out of discretionary spending. They're not coming out of Medicare, Medicaid, the military budget, and so on. And that's where the money really is. In the federal budget, that's where the money is.
Is there a way? We discussed this on the program a few months ago, and I want to find out whether everybody at this table thinks that this is a harebrained idea. And this would be something that maybe it's proposed at the federal level. And it's proposed at the state level, and everybody is given a significant amount of time to plan, let's say 3 to 4 years, to sort of prepare for this somewhat draconian, radical approach to trying to deal with some of the fiscal issues. And that is, there would be an element of the state budget and the federal budget that would be cut by a defined percentage across the board. There would be some programs that might be viewed as left of center. There might be some programs viewed as right of center. And this super commission would agree that on such and such a date, all funding will stop for 365 days. It's just going to stop for 365 days. And then it's coming back. And then maybe the next year, there's another series of programs that are going to be cut for 365 days. Would something like that ever make sense economically? It's not going to make any sense politically. Economically. David,
I guess I'm very skeptical of the idea that you can stop and restart programs without doing a lot of damage. Most of these programs,
there would be pain. There's no question. There would be pain across all sectors, but everyone would be feeling the pain. No one would be without shared sacrifice for the desire to drive down the deficit. And maybe this is a 10 or 15 year plan, but everybody has enough time to plan how their life is going to be affected. It could mean there are no after school programs in any school in America. It may mean for a year there are no music teachers, PE teachers. There's no football season. I'm talking about dramatic things that everybody is going to suffer and joint sacrifice.
I'd rather see a 3% increase in taxes on billionaires. I think that would be a better thing for America, and in the long run, a much better thing for the country.
How is that shared sacrifice?
It's, well, what you have in the last 30 years, for example, wage levels for the average person have been frozen in place, and the upper 5% have seen a 30% improvement in their wage structure.
What I'm saying,
I think if you look at shared sacrifice, they've gotten the benefit for the last 30 years. Let's see some shared sacrifice.
For the sake of my little bizarre idea here, that's dismissed. That's thrown out because you know what? That is a union inspired left of center thing. And by the way, no side can make a statement like that. No side can make a statement. Your response to my suggestion. It's radical.
It is.
Everybody's got to feel pain. Everybody.
I agree that everyone has to feel pain. People the average American's been tightening their belts and has tightened their belt in tough economic times, and I think the government at local, state, and federal level needs to do the same. I don't know that you would necessarily need to do something that draconian. You know, we didn't get into this mess overnight. We're not going to get out of it overnight. You want to do some serious reforms. There's going to be different constituencies that are going to get angry. You can come up with some more incremental ways to accomplish these things. Without doing something so dramatic, but I think the spirit behind what you're saying, that everyone needs to feel pain, that no program is, there's no sacred cow, that for many Republicans, you need to say, look, defense spending's on the table in terms of making some serious cuts and looking at efficiencies and duplication there. I think that's fair game, as you might look and say, the Department of Education might need to be completely eliminated.
All right.
I like how I snuck that in there.
Yeah. Let's go to Dave in Wilmington, Illinois, listening to us on WLS. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. One of the ways that I think we could create a little responsibility and stop overburdening the state and federal budget is by watching the Kid Care Medicaid program, where we reward people for not creating one or two or three, I'm not going to use the word, but fatherless children. And when you have a situation like that, I think the answer is this. One, okay, you made a mistake. After the child is 5 years old, you better figure out how to be responsible and get a job when that kid's in school. If you have two, you better start going after baby daddies and getting the money from the baby daddies, because I see this. And I cannot believe the young kids that have two, three, even more kids, and they're not even in their early 20s.
But here's my point. Let's say you want to get real tough with your policy. What do you do if they don't have the money? I mean, that's what they're going to say.
Well, then maybe they shouldn't have them, so maybe we should do something and create orphanages.
But then, okay, who is going to pay for the orphanages?
Well, it'll get a problem, I believe, under control, because if the sperm donor could be identified, then, okay, maybe we'll cooperate a little bit with you and do some help. But if there's not going to be a contribution on the sperm donor's part, then why should you or me be held up by a bunch of thieves creating these unwanted kids? Because if they were really wanted, I think the people would be responsible. Because I had two kids, and I know a lot of people had one or two, because they had brains and they were responsible. They weren't selfish. They weren't ignorant. And they weren't thinking that it was somebody else's responsibility to take care of them.
Now, you know what? The point is, stay on the line. Because, you know, this caller's remedy does not seem within the realm of possibility. But this caller represents a lot of people. Yep. A lot of people are saying and cheering what you've just said.
Look,
I see it. I know it.
I think everybody around the table knows that there are a lot of people who think the way you think. But the question is, the remedy that you've proposed will not work in America.
Well, the problem I see
something,
as it
something,
is.
Something has got to be done. And, you know, the other point is, because your point is, okay, let's say you have deadbeat dads. Let's just look at the thing. All right, deadbeat dads, they can't pay. So now you're saying you're setting up the bureaucracy of the orphanages. So that's going to set up another agency. The federal government or the state government is still going to be paying for those children. The children are still being born. You want to punish the deadbeat dad, so you send them to prison. You have to build the prison. It's already the second fastest growing entity of government.
I'm not necessarily saying send them to prison, but the thing is this. There has to be some kind of deterrent to this kind of accepted lifestyle. I see it as a way these people think they could survive because they get more money. I don't see it as a way, well, gee, I had a mistake, and isn't this nice that somebody's helping me? It's like, well, gee, I got another one. I'll get more money.
David.
Look, in the mid-1990s, in 1996, we passed a major welfare reform. That took actually a lot of cooperation from both Democrats and Republicans. They both gave a little bit. And that program was much harsher on poor people that didn't work. It forced them into the labor market. What we learned from that experience was, first of all, you can drive down the unemployment rate a lot, or the non-employment rate for single mothers in particular a lot. I think it personally had some good consequences, but we also learned that there's a lot of people that can't effectively go into the labor market and earn a living. There's a lot of people with disabilities, with low IQs, with other kinds of problems, drug addiction, et cetera. And we ended up spending just as much, if not more, on that population. I think there are good reasons for demanding that people be responsible, but I don't think it will solve the budget problem.
Okay, we're going to have to pause. 1-800-723-8289. Lots of callers on the line, including somebody who's going to stand up for billionaires. When we come back. From Cucamonga, California to Tucumcari, New Mexico, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway. Let's head southwest to Corpus Christi, where Mike is listening to us on XM Satellite Radio tonight. Go ahead. Nice to have you with us.
Good evening, Bruce, and good evening to your entire panel.
Great. Nice to have you with us.
To your gentleman who commented about the billionaires having taxes raised on them, first of all, I'm about 995, probably 999.9 million below the billionaire level, but it's not the government's money. You don't go, you don't deserve it. You haven't earned it. There is no reason in the world why you get to have this money and to redistribute it anywhere.
All right, Don Turner.
Well, let's just say, in principle, every person in America is equal in our political process. But in practice and in reality, we know that some of us are more equal than others. And billionaires can field an army of lobbyists. They can finance think tanks. They can put the desired spin on public issues. They can funnel cash into politicians with sympathetic views, as the Koch brothers do. But on paper, we're all one person, one vote. But in reality, we're more like an oligarchy in which a handful of very wealthy people have control over institutions. And there's
by the way, those same people that you talked about doing all those dastardly things, they can fund universities. They can fund research.
They do.
That cures diseases.
Look, Bruce, I'm not saying that.
And on the flip side of the political spectrum, there's George Soros, billionaire, funding his own think tanks. There's a couple of very politically powerful unions on the other side.
Look, I'm not saying that these people are evil incarnate. I'm saying that they have undue influence because of their money in the political process. And by doing that, it diminishes the power of one person being equal to another person.
Go ahead, John.
I don't see how that pertains to a millionaire's tax. I think what you're talking about, maybe some sort of campaign finance reform or reform of how government works and individuals, that's a sort of a different topic. But in terms of punishing people for their success, I think it's both principally and philosophically off base. In principle, it's immoral. There's no reason that one person should be discriminated against because they were successful. And practically speaking, these are the people that fund cancer research. These are the people that fund that hire people that invest their money that they've earned to create jobs.
David, a question to you, because you said a little bit earlier, whether you're talking about $62 billion. Again, it's a drop in the bucket to what really needs to be done and what really needs to be cut. In the debate that we will hear more and more of as people are raising the possibility of cutting federal government, shutting the government down, you're going to have discussions where this costs, $182 billion and this costs $350 million, and all these figures are going to be thrown out. And the professional pundits are going to say, yeah, but that's not really a lot of money. Now, to the average person, $150 million is a lot of money.
Right.
So a series of $151 million projects, can add up. Keep adding them up. So that's too small. We can't take any money away from public broadcasting because we shouldn't do that.
I don't say that we shouldn't. We absolutely should. We should look at all the spending, and it is a lot of money. What I'm saying is the balance of the public debate, what we're talking about, what we're spending our time thinking about and fighting about should be where the real money is, and that is health care. And that is the reason people aren't talking about that is because it's going to be require some sacrifice and require us to make some decisions. If we want to continue the Medicare system as people age, then we're going to have more revenue, or we're going to have to radically change the healthcare system.
Somebody said a little bit earlier, isn't the core of this, the core of what we're talking about, whether it's in Wisconsin or whether we're talking about in the government, when we're talking about what the expectation of people is, the problem is not the Republicans, it's not the Democrats, it's not the liberals, it's not the conservatives. It is us. It is the people who vote, and in many cases, it may be even more so, the people who don't vote. They want something for nothing.
I absolutely
agree
with that.
They want their Groupon coupon.
Right.
They want it, and they don't want to spend money for it, or they want it at a discount, and they want more, and they want somebody else to pay for it. Well, they either want billionaires to pay for it, they want people to get off welfare and let them get off their butts and get to work and pay for it, but nobody wants to look in the mirror and say, this is what I want, and this is what I'm willing to pay for. Nobody wants it.
Absolutely. Everybody.
So how is this ever going to be resolved? Aren't we dealing with human nature?
People have to get more informed. They have to understand where the problem is, what the issue is.
But isn't it human nature
to want something for nothing. People are going to continue to want something for nothing. They have to they can't have it.
But the problem is greed then.
No, look, are there people out there who want something for nothing? Absolutely. I'm going to disagree with you a little bit.
Okay.
I think a little bit better of our fellow Americans in the sense that
– You must be running for something.
No.
Never say that.
Bruce, I think that some people do think that. But at the end of the day, I think what really comes down to is people are willing to share in the sacrifice, are willing to have some of those major reforms, but I think they don't actually believe that if they give that up that it won't just go to another wasteful program. And I think that's one of the positive things. While we are talking about small, you know, just joking, of course, just 10, 20, 30 billion here and there, it's a good step both in terms of the numbers and mentally.
That was John O'Hara, Vice President of External Relations for the Illinois Policy Institute, and your email address is, or website?
IllinoisPolicy.org.
David Merriman is also joins us. He is the Associate Director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs, and if people want to get to you, how do they get to you? Website?
They can go to the University of Illinois website and look for the Institute of Government and Public Affairs.
Don Turner, you are retired. You don't want to talk to anybody because you're not getting paid to do it anymore. Don Turner, the former president of the Chicago Federation of Labor. Thanks very much, gentlemen, for a very enlightening conversation. And to our callers from coast to coast and border to border, we appreciate your participation as well. Tom Veracruz and Dan Dorfman help make this program possible. It's produced by Jenny B. Production from Chicago. This is Bruce Dumont. Good night, everybody.